people are being subverted, not only by multinational companies, but by their own government. Really, there's a lot of human rights violations that are occurring, much worse than Canada. This is a human rights violation in our definition.
After banking and the financial sector, mining is Canada's largest export in terms of its international presence of Canadian multinational corporations. And Canadian mining projects are systematically engaged in ecological disasters wherever they go, whether it's Central America, South America, the Caribbean, Africa, or the Asia Pacific. Canadian mining companies leave a trail of ecological destruction.
They are using the name of Canada. That's a really well-known country as a democratic country, peaceful country, peacemaker country. And when people know about Canada and they hear about Canadians, they open arms in the beginning. But when they know that it's coming a mining open pit, or it's coming a huge extractive industry that's doing a huge damage to the environment, people start getting like totally opposite thinking about Canadians, right? Because Canadians companies are using this name a lot.
And whether it's displacing indigenous peoples or poor peasants from their land and then poisoning their water systems, mining is a very environmentally destructive process, particularly when it's not being properly regulated, which it's not, either by the Canadian government or by most third world governments.
They use the technology that we know as open pit. It's not just destroy the environment, right? To get the minerals from the earth, what they have to do is destroy the surface. To access to under surface, they have to destroy everything that is in the surface. And in the surface is the people, the village, the town, the river, the trees, the forest, everything that is in the surface, it has to be destroyed.
And so as a result, you have commonly, you see mining companies dump their waste, which includes high levels of arsenic or cyanide and so on and other chemicals, into local water systems, or they create what they call a tailings pond for their waste, which is supposed to be properly lined, but they don't do it properly, and then the water, the toxic water leaks into the soil, into the waterbed in the local community, and it destroys plant life. It poisons people, and it's well documented from Guatemala to Honduras to the Dominican Republic to Tanzania. And beyond, it's well documented the toxic impact of Canadian mining companies, and the Canadian government does nothing. It does zero about this.
I think that we have to be very mindful of the fact that Canada continues to generate all its wealth, all its assets, everything on the backs of Indigenous peoples. And that the entire economic paradigm of this country is based on keeping Indigenous people subjugated and keeping us from having self-determination and control over our land and resources.
Canada doesn't live up to their human rights, what is they're obligated to do by the under what is known as the United Nations Indigenous Peoples Conference. Well, really, there's a covenant within the United Nations where it says free, prior, and informed consent, yet Canada does not live up to it. And that's, really what they're doing is subverting a lot of international laws as well as their own proclamations where they stated that they have a fiduciary duty to protect Indigenous people.
Canada, like America, like Europe, like Australia, like Israel, is a huge advocate of human rights when it advances their neoliberal free market agenda. Last year, Canada went through their periodical UN Human Rights Review, and they scored eighth on the planet in the UN Human Rights Index. But when the committee analyzed Canada's human rights record through its Aboriginal policy and its treatment of Indigenous peoples, Canada scored 48th.
Obviously, Canada has a very deep-rooted relationship to colonialism within Canadian borders. the whole existence of Canada is premised on the dispossession of First Nations peoples and the colonial administration of their communities by the Canadian government via Indian Affairs. But also, even outside Canadian borders, there's a long history of Canadian colonial or imperial practices. For example, the banking industry has a long history in the Caribbean and Latin America. There are mining companies that have relationships to various Central American dictatorships or the dictatorship in Indonesia in the Cold War period. So there's a long history of colonialism, both within and beyond Canada.
It's more than colonialism. It's, you know, killing the spirit of a nationhood, the belief of a nationhood. You know, it's not colonialism anymore. It's too radical. It's too racial, the approach that this federal government is taken, ignoring the First Nation people, you know, who use and occupy the land.
You know, a lot of people don't get educated in school about how Indian reservations were created. A lot of people don't understand that, you know, the South African apartheid system was based on the reservation apartheid system here in Canada. You know, we didn't have these settlements prior to colonization. For example, residential schools, where they took our children away from our parents for 100 years and put them into essentially work camps and beat them for speaking their language and cut their hair. You know, and these schools were magnets for, you know, predators, sexual predators of kids. You know, a lot of the nuns and priests and groundskeepers and whatnot were straight up pedophiles. A lot of our kids, including my own mom and, you know, a lot of my relatives that went, you know, faced severe abuse, sexual, physical abuse when they went to residential school. And I think that what a lot of people don't understand is that Canada is an apartheid country, you know. It still is in very many ways.
Historically, when capitalism emerges in Canada, the focus of the Canadian state vis-a-vis Indigenous peoples was to destroy their Indigenous cultures, their economies, their polities, and so on, and forcefully remove them from the land. And the goal was to gain access to the land and its subsurface minerals and resources. And I would argue that that has been definitive of Canada's relationship with Indigenous peoples ever since to the present day.
The language that is utilized by the Canadian government in dealing with First Nations and talking about their relationship with First Nations globally is the same colonial racist language used by the Zionist government of Israel when talking about Palestinians. It's grounded in the same Eurocentric kind of white patriarchal, you know, kind of power base, you know, that subjugates and looks at, you know, either Palestinian or Indigenous peoples as children, you know, that need to be taken care of as a problem.
The value of our culture, of the land, of the rivers and the lakes, of the practices, of the traditions, is worth so much more than the blood money dollar bills that they keep waving in our faces. Our culture, our lands, our rivers and our waters is more than priceless. It is sacred, and we aren't going to sell it down the river for a couple of, for a pipeline that is guaranteed to destroy our lives.
Shallow Waters is about a future where the land is intoxicated and it's polluted and uninhabitable, and it's sad because, and it's scary because that future is possible if we keep continuing on this industrial road that we're on. It's about a future where the Harper government and industry has turned our lands in BC into a giant Walmart.
Well, we're just wrapping up here. The Yinkadeni Alliance leadership has just come out of the annual general shareholder meeting of Enbridge. They're very clear and concise that there's absolutely no way that this pipeline nor the supertanker traffic that it promises to bring to the West Coast will ever happen. And yeah, we're tired, a little bit wet, but feeling very positive.
No tankers, no pipeline, no tankers, no pipeline, no tankers, no pipeline, no tankers, no pipeline, no tankers, no pipelines, no tankers, no pipeline.
We tried it every way, even the environmental laws we use, their laws, and they change it. They change it while we're still fighting. Harper doesn't care. Harper doesn't care about us. He's going to take us to court. We're going to stand in court. I don't care how long we're going to be in court, we're going to be there. My heart's hurting right now. Because governments are not going to listen. Never ever going to listen. Only reason why they're doing this, they're trying to take more of our land. We're a part of this country too. They can't go on and reap the land without suffering us on a reserve. Everybody thinks Indians get it good. We don't. We come back to our homelands and look at how we live. We live like third world country. Inadequate water, inadequate homes. They say they give us everything. We have to abide by three or four laws before we can be able to stand up and do anything. But today, we're abiding by our own hereditary law, our traditional law, the Batlats, our area. That's what we're going to stand on, and that's how we're going to win. Chanachaya! Saketne!
The earth is coming to its place of fulfillment, I guess, in terms of all of the population, the damage to the water, all of that put together. I think we're coming into a time, I don't know when this is going to happen, but I think we're coming into a time where the earth has to heal itself and it has to renew itself.
Our own Cree Nation has a prophecy, the prophecy of the seventh generation, that speaks of a time when a generation of young people would come up and they would be free from the colonial mind, you know, where they would still understand, you know, the violence of colonization, but they would not be crippled by it, and they would, you know, take action. Our prophecy talks about that, and I believe that that's right now. Right where we are.
I've heard the prophecy where the people have to unite, have to become one to make that change, to change that renewal process.
And while many get depressed or overwhelmed and even apathetic about, you know, things like climate change and you know, the austerity agenda of these neoconservative maniacs that are running our country, I see a tremendous amount of hope and light emerging in a social movement that is rising up, you know, to combat against the drivers of climate change, to combat against this economic paradigm, and I'm filled with hope.
انسان را مطمئن می کند ذکر خدا ذکر الله تطمئن القلوب.
Be aware, the hearts find rest in Allah's remembrance.
Spring of truth.
Allahu ya Allah.
This is a part of political divine will of the founder of Islamic Republic of Iran, Imam Khomeini. As a humble student of theology, like other Muslim brothers, I have hope in this revolution, perpetuation of its outcome and its increasing fruition. I would like to express some matters to the beloved present and future generations. Even though I may sound repetitious, I beg the forgiving Allah to bless my remarks. We know that this great revolution, which has virtually cut off the hands of the world aggressors and oppressors from Iran, succeeded only with unseen divine blessings. Otherwise, it would have been impossible for a nation of millions to succeed despite all the anti-Islamic and anti-clerical propaganda, especially in the last century.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. Dear audience, thank you for joining us on another new episode of Spring of the Truth from IRIB English Radio. I'm Zainab Mousavi, and in this program we try to elaborate and contemplate on some of the precious speeches of Imam Khomeini rahmatullah alayh on different subjects. Well, about the subject of knowledge, Imam rahmatullah says that if our country acquires knowledge and culture and learn how to direct knowledge and action, no power can rule over it. Well, there are several messages implied in this statement. First is that victory of a nation can be achieved only under the umbrella of knowledge. So knowledge is a pillar for power, and if the government intends to be respected by other nations, it must learn different aspects of knowledge. The knowledge of a nation must be accompanied by culture, which means that working on the cultural aspects of a nation is of utmost importance. These cultural aspects are moral values, social participations, and conventions that are required to be followed in order to give a nation the sense of unity. One important point, just as Imam Rahmatullah Alayh rightly mentions, is the direction of knowledge, which means that not every type of knowledge is accommodating for the society. Well, one of the interpretations of this sentence could be that this way is the best way of directing a field of science or knowledge to make it useful for people. Such an important hint that Imam is making represents his enlightened view that detects most of the effective use of knowledge. Welcome back. Another lesson found within this speech is that in order for a nation to be strong and unbeatable, it must fortify not only its political powers, but also other aspects such as culture, science, which are the secrets of victory. Well, it seems that the time of this episode has come to its end. Now, before we end this episode, let's recite this valuable speech of Imam Khomeini rahmatullah about knowledge and the knowledgeable. In this regard, he says that if our country acquires knowledge and culture and learn how to direct knowledge and action, no power can rule over it. Thank you so much for listening to this episode. Until another episode and greeting, I leave you all in the care and protection of Allah the Almighty.
السلام عليكم ورحمة الله.
every night and every day. Never forget to say La ilaha illallah.
Join us in this journey. IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
Insights into the Holy Quran.
Indeed, this Quran guides to what is most upright and gives the good news to the faithful who do righteous deeds, that there is a great reward for them.
In the name of Allah, the Compassionate, the Merciful, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Assalamu Alaikum. Welcome to another edition of the program, Insights into the Holy Quran by Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hawza Seminary of Qom. Please stay with us.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين ثم الصلاة والسلام على سيدنا محمد وآله الطاهرين. In the name of Allah, the most beneficent, the most merciful. Hello everyone, I'm Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi and we're going to be with you with another edition of the program Insights into the Holy Quran. And in this edition of the program, we'll try to discuss the commentary of chapter Shu'ara, the 26th chapter of the Holy Quran. We'll be back after you listen to the verses we're going to discuss in this episode.
A'udhu billahi minash shaytanir rajim. Wama as'alukum alayhi min ajr. In ajriya illa ala rabbil alamin.
and I do not ask you for it any payment. My payment is only from the Lord of the worlds. So fear Allah and obey me.
قَالُوا أَنُؤْمِنُ لَكَ وَاتَّبَعَكَ الْأَرْذَلُونَ
They said, should we believe you while you are followed by the lowest class of people?
Brothers and sisters, we were discussing these verses of chapter Shu'ara. وَمَا أَسْأَلُكُمْ عَلَيْهِ مِنْ أَجْرٍ إِنْ أَجْرِيَ إِلَّا عَلَى رَبِّ الْعَالَمِينَ فَاتَّقُوا اللَّهَ وَأَطِيعُونَ قَالُوا أَنُؤْمِنُ لَكَ وَاتَّبَعَكَ الْأَرْضَلُونَ And I do not ask you any recompense for it. My recompense is only from the Lord of the worlds. So then be in awe of Allah and obey me. And they said, shall we believe in you while the meanest follow you? So Prophet Noah tried to resort to his rightfulness, his trustworthiness, he reminded for them again. And because this is a spiritual matter, this is only invitation to monotheism, he made this absolutely clear that he is not asking any recompense for it. He is not looking for wealth and benefit. And he is only relying on his Lord for providing him whatever he needs. But this was the answer of those pretext seekers. They said, shall we believe in you while the meanest follow you? أَنُؤْمِنُ لَكَ وَاتَّبَعَكَ الْأَرْذَلُونَ They added that they could never deal with such a group of people because they had never sat with them at one table. They had never gathered with them under one ceiling. And this is a very irrational expectation to want them to be together under one ceiling, under one roof. And they were, and from this perspective, when we look at it, they were right. The value of a leader can be recognized by his followers. And so to speak, a shrine is known by means of its visitors. It is true that they were right and correct in this matter, that a leader can be known by means of his followers, but their great mistake was that they had lost the concept and criterion of personality. For them, as we mentioned, the criterion of measuring the values of people was property, was wealth, was beautiful, costly clothing and houses and mounts. And they were neglectful of spiritual things like purity, piety, and rightfulness. Those things that could be found abundantly among the poor classes of their society and were very scarce among the notable and noble ones. This was their biggest mistake.
على مر الزمان تألقا وأضاء للدنيا طريقا
We hope and pray that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala blesses us with the ability to cover more of His divine
In this
word.
Series of programs, we will inshallah discuss the Holy Quran with a thematic approach.
We will inshallah discuss the chapter.
تعلقا وتلاه في جنح الدجى متدبرا
The context in which Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala speaks in this verse is the context of mentioning the ills and problems and evils of the people of the book, the previous nations who have received revelation, and more particularly the Jew.
Now let's listen to some of the verses of the Holy Quran.
First, let's listen to a few verses.
Now let's listen to some verses of the Holy Quran.
Oh,
Insights into the Holy Quran by Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hausa Seminary of Qom.
So this was the worst form of thought, ruling their ideas. So they counted the poor class of the society as the meanest level. This is what we understand from the word أَرْضَلُونَ, as the verse says, وَاتَّبَعَكَ الْأَرْضَلُونَ, while the meanest followed you. The Arabic word أَرْضَل has the plural form of أَرَاذِل, and it is itself also a plural form of رَذْل, that means low and mean. If they came out of the prison of the social class division, they might clearly understand that the belief of this group was the best evidence for the legitimacy and authenticity of the call of the Prophet, because they were the ones having this piety and purity, and they were the ones who were gathered around such man of divine prophethood. I mean, there are some other ways that we can understand he was the Prophet, because he, at first, he made this clear that I'm not looking for any benefit. He stopped the people bringing excuses. He stopped the pretext seekers. He said that I am only relying on my Lord, and this is a spiritual matter. All of his followers, most of them, were the ones who were unknown. وَاتَّبَعَكَ الْأَرْضَلُونَ. And he were right, and most of the time, the ones who are right have least followers in the societies. وَاتَّبَعَكَ الْأَرْضَلُونَ. These groups of people were making the minority of the society, so, and we also know that we should not disrespect an idea, an ideology, a belief, because of its few followers. We will continue discussing the verses of this chapter, dear listeners, later on. Thank you for staying with us. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Don't be saddened by what you see, by all the lies and treachery. Life is cruel, but don't worry. In your heart lies the key to unwind all the secrets of this life we see.
Thank you, dear listeners of IRIB English, for listening to us. If you have any question regarding our programs, feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir. Also, visit our website at parstoday.com. Until the next program, take care and goodbye.
Things always work for me, worry ends when faith begins.
Aperture.
At the height of the Cold War, the CIA launches a highly classified, top-secret research program into the covert use of biological and chemical agents. In simulated attacks on enemy populations, entire cities throughout America are contaminated with bacteria, exposing millions of Americans to germ warfare. But the real focus of the research is on mastering the art of mind control. I'm Daniel Arya, and this is Aperture. LSD had become one of the CIA's key interests for its brain warfare program. As the agency theorized, it could be useful in interrogations. Mind control experiments generally centered around behavior modification via electroshock therapy, hypnosis, polygraphs, radiation, and a variety of drugs, toxins, and chemicals. Now, these experiments relied on a range of test subjects, some who freely volunteered, some who volunteered under coercion, and some who had absolutely no idea that they're involved in a sweeping defense research program. And what was the extent of these brainwashing experiments? How did the CIA use unconsenting people as guinea pigs in thousands of different experiments? Join us on Aperture for your answers on CIA covert experiments.
August 16th, 1951. Madness spreads through the village of Pont-Saint-Esprit in the Gard region in France. Dozens of villagers have been victim of these bouts of madness. The press describes men terrorized by snakes swirling in their stomachs. A doctor recounts the evening of the 25th of August, where dozens of locals were seized by convulsions, like in a night of the apocalypse. Reports from the victims are terrifying. In Pont-Saint-Esprit, they call it the cursed bread drama, because all of those who fell ill ate the bread from the Brion bakery. It's the first time in France that a whole village has gone mad. It made headlines in the press, who wondered what could have caused this collective hallucination. In Pont-Saint-Esprit, the locals panic, and nobody will touch the bread. The hearses quickly arrive in the village. In total, 7 deaths, 300 people poisoned, and around 50 admitted to psychiatric wards. The first dead were buried. The investigators initially thought it was a return of St. Anthony's fire, a disease that killed many thousands in the Middle Ages, caused by a parasitic ergo fungus that attacks cereals. The baker was accused of poisoning, then the miller. Arrested and incarcerated, they were released after several months. They say that their confessions were made under duress, and above all, the evidence proved their innocence. It was then thought to be water poisoning, mercury, fertilizers, or a nearby gas factory. But the evidence disapproved these theories one by one. Since then, in Pont-Saint-Esprit, more far-fetched theories have surfaced. Nothing is clear, and for decades the incident goes unexplained. But against all expectations, 60 years later, a new theory is proposed. Not from France, but from the United States. An American researcher in the Secret Services, Hank Alberelli, is investigating the suspicious death of a biochemist from the CIA, Frank Olson. A specialist in chemical weapons, he carried out experiments on hard drugs like LSD. He was also in France a few months before the Pont-Saint-Esprit incident. Afterwards, he kept sinking into depression, telling his wife that he'd made a terrible mistake. Hank Alberelli then made the link with the Pont-Saint-Esprit incident. Could it have been the CIA and the American Army spraying LSD onto the bread?
I have no doubt at all that Pont-Saint-Esprit was a U.S. Army covert experiment. Initially, I had doubts, and I think initially my doubts were motivated by wishful thinking on my part, where I didn't want it to be an experiment. It was hard to fathom the government doing that. Although at the same time, there were a number of research tracks that were being conducted for the book at the same time. So my being naive about what the government and the U.S. Army was capable of doing was the threshold for that was dwindling.
Is it possible that the Americans drugged an entire village in an ally country, causing, no doubt accidentally, the death of 7 people? Improbable. However, to understand what happened in Pont-Saint-Esprit, we need to look back at the end of the Second World War, when the level of atrocities committed by the Nazis was discovered in the camps, notably horrific experiments carried out on thousands of prisoners by chemists or doctors. Men lacerated, poisoned, burnt alive, exposed to radiation. The Allies hunted the war criminals from Hitler's regime. In 1946, in Nuremberg, the doctors are put on trial. 22 men and one woman who experimented on human beings, who they transformed into lab rats, stand accused. The trial sets a precedent. 7 of the accused are sentenced to death, 11 given prison sentences, and 5 are acquitted. As a result, the Americans draft the Nuremberg Code, a model which gives strict rules for experimenting on humans, notably the voluntary consent of the human subject is absolutely essential. The experiment must be designed to avoid all unnecessary suffering, physical and mental harm. With the Nuremberg trial barely over, the winners remain cynical. The American Secret Service begins Operation Paperclip. Nearly 1,500 German scientists, including war criminals, are expatriated to America. They are offered a new life in exchange for their knowledge and cooperation.
It was a very serious game of propaganda that we were playing. It was almost a show trial. We're putting the Nazis on trial, but in fact, behind the curtain, we're doing some very nasty things ourselves to basically incarcerated people, poor people, individuals who at the time were called feeble-minded and locked up in institutions. And if you were in one of those institutions, whether you were indigent or an unwed mother or had some sort of mental incapacity, there's a good chance that you may have been incorporated in some sort of medical study, possibly for the government or not, where you would have been used and abused.
Assisted by the German scientists, the Americans begin pursuing their goal of the ultimate weapon, and everything is allowed in the name of the Cold War. On the one side was the Army, whose priority is to win the nuclear arms race. At the time, to test the effects of radiation on a large scale, they used their own soldiers, who were docile and disciplined. Between 1946 and 1962, between 250,000 and 500,000 men were exposed to radiation on Bikini Atoll or in the Nevada desert. They were exposed with no protection, unaware of the risks involved, and afterwards the radiated particles were cleaned up with brooms.
How about radiation? You think there's much danger from radiation?
Well, radiation is the least of the worries that the men are thinking about.
I think most people thought that radiation was the greatest danger, didn't they? Where did they learn different?
Well, prior to our instructions here, we received a very thorough briefing before we even came in this close to contact with it.
On the other side was the CIA, who was above all interested in psychological manipulation. Their goal was to create an infallible truth serum, wipe memories, turn humans into robots, and program them to kill. Conveniently, in 1948, a researcher in the Sandoz laboratories, Albert Hoffman, discovers a molecule that ignites the Secret Service, lysergic acid diethylamide, or LSD. It's derived from the same rye fungus, long held responsible for the incident at Pont-Saint-Esprit. It was believed that the hallucinogenic properties of this drug were key to psychological manipulation. Fearing that the Russians would get their hands on Sandoz's samples, the Americans bought all of their stock. The discovery of LSD was a godsend for the Army, who on the brink of nuclear weapons were looking for a weapon that could defeat an enemy without firing any weapons. The man who was head of this program longest was James Ketchum, shown here in uniform. He was a psychiatrist who was working for the military. As a patriot, he was prepared to push the boundaries in his research. He tested around 30 drugs, but especially LSD and the dangerous benzylate. He treated 7,000 soldiers, hundreds of whom later sued the army because of the side effects that they still experience and attribute to these drugs. However, when questioned, James Ketchum sees things differently.
I think they were very patriotic. They've not been given credit. They've been called innocent guinea pigs, which they certainly were not. They knew what they were doing, and we told them as much as we could about it. We had to limit the names of the drugs because some of them were artificially made. And if we were to give out the name, of course, that would also reveal the structure, and that we were afraid the Russians would get that. They were apparently following our work. We thought they were ahead of us, but actually they weren't. And so they were watching what we did to see what they could learn and use, and they developed a similar drug later themselves.
In parallel with the Army, the CIA was also developing its own programs, codenamed Bluebird, Artichoke, and later MKUltra. But to carry out these programs on a large scale, they needed funds. In 1950, the Korean War gave them the ideal pretext. Some American soldiers were captured. During their detention, pilots admitted having dropped chemical weapons onto Korea, which was forbidden. The Americans claimed this was due to psychological manipulation, and the CIA took advantage of this godsend to obtain budgets that allowed them to work on brainwashing.
During the Korean War, the American pilots who were captured started making apparently false confessions of germ warfare. The first question is, was it really false confessions? But then when they were brought back to the United States, the military and the military psychiatrists studied them and decided that there's mind control operations being run against Americans. So for defensive purposes, we had to study this, figure it out. Therefore, we created MKUltra. Before MKUltra was Bluebird and Artichoke. So the whole rationale is it's defensive. It's because of what the communists are doing. Problem is, the Korean War started in June 1950, and Bluebird was signed into operation by the head of the CIA in April 1950.
In the Edgewood camp where James Ketchum worked, soldiers are called upon more and more. They think they're testing gas masks. In reality, the canisters are filled with a toxic chemical.
They were testing a whole assortment of different hallucinogens like LSD and marijuana and things like that. And they explored other drugs, very high levels of atropine, scopolamine, benzolates, very powerful. And a lot of these soldiers ended up incapacitated. It took them a long time to recover. And while they're in recovery, the doctors cannot do any more experiments because it's basically a very small base and testing operation. In other words, they needed a new site.
It's in this context of the Cold War and secret agents that on the 16th of August, 1951, the tragedy at Pont Saint-Esprit unfolded. France was suffering economically, and the Americans distrusted this ally they couldn't control. The village was under the control of socialists at the time. In the eyes of America, they were Reds, the epitome of the Soviet danger. But the mayor, Roger Castillon, doesn't believe in a foreign conspiracy. Yet American experts like Colin Ross are much more down to earth.
Obviously, that compound didn't just come in the rain. or just wasn't sitting around naturally. It was obviously organized, controlled, distributed. So whether it was actually LSD or some other compound, well, doesn't make that much difference. Pont Saint-Esprit is actually not just this happened once in the world in a village in France. It's consistent with all the other experiments on the public that have done in the United States and done for a documented fact.
To achieve their goals, would the Americans be prepared to use a whole village as a laboratory? After all, these are civilians, not trained soldiers. However, in September 1950, nearly 1 year before Pont Saint-Esprit, this is exactly what they did, and in their own country. Off the coast of San Francisco, the American Marines were carrying out military maneuvers. A ship approached the coast and bombarded the city with a bacteria causing nucosomia, Serratia marcescens. The military were testing the effects of spraying this through the air. This classified secret defense map shows the scale of the targeted area. At least 11 people were hospitalized, one of whom died of pneumonia. The villagers wonder why a supposedly festive drug that is loved by hippies would have had such terrifying effects at Pont Saint-Esprit. James Ketchum, the military psychiatrist who specialized in LSD, a little reluctantly, admits that the drug is scary for those who take it unknowingly.
Some individuals could have a bad trip if someone gave them LSD and didn't tell them about it. That's very anxiety-producing. Or if they were inexperienced and not particularly well-balanced themselves, took a fairly large dose of LSD, they could have a bad trip. How would you feel if you had a cup of coffee and started to see things going like this or like this, brilliant colors appear on the ceiling, or suddenly you felt you're out of your body and looking down on yourself? These are all things that can happen with LSD.
But can these effects have a delayed onset? In Pont Saint-Esprit, the older generation remember the night of the apocalypse, where dozens of men went mad and were sectioned in a psychiatric unit because of terrifying visions. This night took place more than 2 weeks after the cursed bread was consumed. But again, James Ketchum admits that it's possible.
Some individuals had flashbacks later in which they would go into a situation where they had been when they were taking LSD and have a flood of the same emotions and some of them anxiety producing.
In 1951, French investigators also consider LSD and call upon Albert Hoffman, inventor of the drug. On the spot, he tells the investigators that he has no doubt that the hallucinations were due to LSD. But after returning to Switzerland, he backtracks, claiming he was mistaken. The French want explanations, but public health documents from 1951 show that the expert became suddenly unreachable. We are sorry that the eminent professor has not been able to get back in touch with us.
I would think if the Sandoz scientists are saying it doesn't seem to be LSD, they're just trying to cover up the fact that it's 100% for sure that LSD must have come from Sandoz, because they were the only suppliers. It's nothing more than a cover-up.
After months of inquiry, the French investigators were so disoriented by the number of fruitless leads that the incident at Pont Saint-Esprit falls victim to its own mystery. During this time, the experiments continued in the United States, and they reached a level never seen before in any country, including the Soviet bloc.
Ask the followers of the remembrance if ye know not.
You're listening to the program The Key,
on IRIB English Radio with Shiraz Hossein Agha, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom and a PhD in philosophy.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Welcome to our program, The Key, here at IRIB English Radio. Today on The Key, we are going to be asking a question regarding whether cursing the disbelievers is one of the conducts of the prophets, the Anbiya, alayhimus salam, or not. And whether the prophets cursed the disbelievers who existed amongst their nation, the nation to whom they were sent or not. It should be noted that this act of cursing the disbelievers is something that God himself did, the Prophet of Islam had done, the Ayyamah alayhimus salam did. And many holy personages like these, you know, in various cases and in various circumstances, this has been related from them. In the Holy Quran, we read that a lot of people who did not accept the invitation of the prophets and remained in their state of disbelief were cursed by their prophets. And following this curse, they were punished, and the punishment and azab of God was sent upon them. For example, the Prophet Noah, Prophet Nuh, after preaching to his people for many centuries and inviting them towards God and monotheism, he lost hope in their belief, and he cursed them. In the Holy Quran we read, Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, وَقَالَ نُوحٌ رَبِّ لَا تَذَرْ عَلَى الْأَرْضِ مِنَ الْكَافِرِينَ دَيَّارًا. O God, do not allow to remain on this earth even one disbeliever. As in one case, in another place we read something similar regarding the Prophet Moses. He cursed the Pharaoh, the hosts of the Pharaoh, the followers of the Pharaoh. He said, O God, destroy their wealth, and because of their sins, make their hearts hard, harden their hearts, and in such a way that they never believe, and they become afflicted with a painful punishment. This is in Surah Yunus, verse 88. Also, the Prophet Shu'aib, alayhi salam, he cursed his nation. In Surah A'raf, verse 89, we read the following that has been related from him. He says, I only rely and trust in God, my Lord. And then he asks God, he says, O God, judge between me and my nation truthfully, and you are the best of judges. Right, so these are all indications that, yes, this was a conduct of the Prophet, albeit after they lost hope in, certain people ever believing in them and believing in monotheism and believing in God and adhering to righteousness. Once they lost hope, they would curse their nation. But before that, you know, it wasn't that the prophets would just automatically begin to curse, the disbelievers. That's definitely not one of the conducts of the prophets and the men of God. Thank you for joining us here on The Key. We were looking at whether the cursing of the disbelievers was a conduct of the prophets or not. Until next time, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi